Hey guys, just a heads up, my microphone cut out right towards the end of this interview, so we've re-recorded a few questions towards the end of the episode, and you'll barely notice the difference, but in case you do, that's what's happened.
If you think about sport, it's really simple. Sports are games. You know, often it's like ball in net, ball over net. It's some sort of game, and at the end of the day, you know, they're sports, they're very serious, you know, there's physical, but they're games. And the reality is that games, as in the ones that we play on the computer, are like super engaging, and they're much more engaging in some ways than some of these like physical sports or games.
I'm Dan Murray-Serta, and you're listening to Secret Leaders from Infamous Media. We interview fascinating founders so you can leave these shows inspired to do the work of your life. Today's guest is esports pioneer Sam Matthews, the CEO and founder of the gaming giant Fnatic. Now keep listening to find out about Sam's journey from founding Fnatic at just 19 by selling his car to a £100 million valuation today, and how on earth you can ask your mum to exit the business you both helped to create. But first, it's such a new industry. How do you even become an entrepreneur in esports?
I'm not one of those, I guess, more academic-led entrepreneurs who read about it in books for years and you dreamed of being an entrepreneur from when they were a kid. It was just kind of something that, like, I just did, you know. I started like, can I sell everything in the house? Like, mom, I want to do a garage sale, you know, like, well, let's set up like a lemonade stand as a cliche thing just because I see it, and that type of thing. And then I basically ended up playing a lot of video games because I was playing a lot of rugby, and then I'd come home and my brother showed me this Quake 3 where you could play against other people, and it was just hooked. I was like, wow, I can actually get the thrill of competition at like any time, you know, rather than having to like wait for someone to play a board game with me or to go on a football pitch or rugby pitch. It was something that you could just like pick up and like play and compete, and that was such a thrill to me, you know. So I really got into it at uni when I kind of went to a dorm in Southampton and had 100 megabit internet in like 2004, which was quite a good internet connection back then. And because of that, I was like, wow, this is naturally going to be like huge, you know, when internet goes everywhere, when devices get better, when the games get better, people love to compete. Like, of course they're going to want to compete all of the time, any of the time. And so I sold my car and I sent a team to the United States to play in a tournament, which they won. And, you know, in that summer, and that was just before summer holidays. And then the summer holidays, I went back home and my mom was like, what happened to your car? And I was like, well, you know, I kind of sold it this thing. And she was like, I got a bit angry. And then she was like, well, if you're going to do it, let's do it right. You know, I'll put in some money and you can put in some money from your uncle's inheritance, which was like, I don't know, 20K each or something like that. And I'm going to come on and I'm going to run finance. And I'm like, okay. So I gave her half the business, you know, like it was like that. And that's how she got involved at the beginning when I was. That's
so interesting.
Yeah.
So is your mom technically an equal shareholder to you?
She was for a long time.
Let's just go back a second. So, you know, you're at university, you've sold your car, you have got really into gaming, but then you mentioned, you know, you sent a team off to the States. What does that really mean? Like, what, like, and especially in the context of, you know, that might sound a bit more normal now. If you're listening and you're into esports, that might sound somewhat normal now. I guess to normal listeners that don't know much about esports, it's still weird. Then that was really odd. So let's just talk about that for a second. What does it mean to send off a team? And why weren't you in that team? Why weren't you there with them?
Well, you know, as soon as you start like organizing and managing, it like takes a lot of time, right? So I started like, oh, if I'm going to get sponsorships, I then need to get like the best players, and then I need to be in the best games. And already we'd launched like, yeah. So it was kind of like this idea where I'd stumbled into basically running a team I was playing for called Creaturin, which was this terrible team name, especially. And it was kind of like, I tried to like, I guess it was like an entrepreneur. I tried to like, I redid the website, did the branding. I created a sales deck. I did all these things to try, because I wanted to go to an event. I wanted to get sent to this event and I didn't have the money to send myself there. And I sent off like, I don't know, maybe 100 emails to different like sponsors, you know, really long wordy emails that I get like every day now from like 19-year-olds. But I sent one off myself to lots of people. And one guy sent back and said like, well, you know, here's the thing about marketing, you know, like you actually need to have good exposure and good branding and good website. And I was like, yeah, actually this makes sense, and you need to be the best. And so that's when I basically started to think about creating Fnatic, and I, you know, did it at uni, and I got my dorm room guy to draw the logo, the first version, my mate who definitely wasn't an artist. And eventually, like, we launched, and the first big tournament, I was like, well, how am I going to, I picked up the best teams I could find in Europe, and I knew they were the best in the world, but the tournaments were in America. So I was like, I need to get this team there. And I made a deal with them that if I send them there, that I get like my money back plus 20%, basically. And they won, of course. And that was like the start of it, right? It was like, I got my money back. I have some money in the bank, but I probably need some more money because I need to send more teams to different places. So it was kind of like that. But yeah, you're right. Like, it was such a small scene, right? Like, it was people on the internet, on internet relay chat, you know, IRC. And it was like, you know, maybe thousands of people, not hundreds of millions of people, right? So, but it still felt like a scene, and probably like, especially because it's online, because you can like talk to everybody and it feels like something that's big.
Was there no like an option of just doing this remotely anyway? Like, what was the reason that you had to go to these physical tournaments even though it was online? Did you guys find that like a massive barrier, or is the whole point that that's a barrier and it kind of forces you into professionalizing it a bit?
Yeah, so I mean, the number one reason, and it's to this day still very relevant, but also was also very extremely relevant back then, was that if you go to an offline event, you're actually on this, that level playing field, right? You've got the same internet connection, so everyone's on zero ping. There's no latency. And also on top of that, everyone's on the same PC. So it's the only way for it to be fair. Like, and that's the reality is, like, back then, you know, everybody had, like, some people had ISDN and dial-up and stuff like that. So to really have true competition, and it was kind of like, it was like the mecca, you know, going to this location where everybody's on, like, zero ping. It means that it's all about just pure skill of the teams, you know?
Okay, let's get a bit of understanding for listeners at this point before we go even deeper. Can you help us define esports? So, like, I've been friends with you for years, and I only about 2 years ago actually understood what esports teams do. It was so fascinating to me. So can you actually break it down? Like, what is a typical esports team? How do you guys set up? Are there particular games that you guys like gravitate away from? Do you try and do all of them? Is it about like picking the ones that you're best at? Like, take us through, like, literally for the layman. And my mum listens to all my secret leaders. So,
you know. If you think about sport, it's really simple, right? Sports are games. Every one of them, you know, whether it's ultimate frisbee, whether it's tennis, whether it's basketball, you know, often it's like ball in net, ball over net. It's some sort of game. And at the end of the day, you know, they're sports, they're very serious, you know, there's physical, but they're games. And the reality is that games, as in the ones that we play on the computer, are like super engaging, and they're much more engaging in some ways than some of these like physical sports or games, and tactical. And they're also like unlimited in terms of imagination, right? You can pretty much do anything that you want. Like, is this person zero gravity? Like, are they like having laser pointers out of their fingers? Like whatever you can imagine, you can make. And so when you have a game which is like limitless in kind of engagement and entertainment, it basically means that like the only difference between the games which were all kind of like, I don't know, GTA or Cyberpunk now, is that esports arrived when it was like, hold on a minute, why don't we just make people play against each other on the internet, these games? Then we don't need to make like hours and days of worth of content. We can just make like the game that's balanced, and that it's got some basic rules, and we let them compete against one another. And that's basically what was the birth of esports. So it's basically fair to play, fair games where it's like there's a level playing field, and you can play over the internet, you can play on any device, you can play anytime. And because of that, it's so much more accessible. There's like probably around 1 billion to 1.5 billion people playing online ranked competitive video games. Ranked meaning there is like actually built into the game, you're on level bronze, you're on platinum, you're on gold, you're on diamond. And so these are kind of basically like leagues that are built into the games, which you can play from anywhere, you know, in Europe or whatever you want to do. What that led to is that obviously whenever you've got 100 million people playing something and there's a level playing field, there's the people who are insane, right? And they're the best of the best, and they're the people that you want to watch. And actually, it turns out that watching a game that you play is actually really exciting. Who would have thought? You know, like, oh my God, I play football. Watching football is really exciting. Like, it's...
That's right, like the biggest YouTuber, right? PewDiePie, that's all about watching people play games.
Yeah, and it's even more engaging because they're able to talk to those people at the same time. You know, they're able to, like, engage with them in real time and be like, go left, go right, do this, you know, like, you know... And like when they screw up, they're there talking to their fans. So basically esports is born out of basically technical disruption of, well, not disruption, but it's the addition of technology to games and sport. And that's basically what esports is. And it's kind of like, you know, it's been around for like 20 years, but at the same time, it's just beginning.
Whether you're sitting in front of a screen playing games or a screen working, your brain is at work. So you want to give it the best chance it has to thrive. Height Smart Supplement has been formulated by neuroscientists, nutritionists, and dietitians, containing the 20 key nutrients to help with mental performance, clarity, and energy. Plus, it includes all the vitamin D the government says we all need right now, just with lots of added benefits. See how brain care can focus your energy. Go to yourheights.com and use the code LEADERS for £10 off a quarterly subscription today.
When you first described it to me, you called yourself, you know, the Manchester United of the esports world. I'm guessing you probably want to change that to, you know, Real Madrid or Barcelona at times. But hey, it helped solidify the point. So what does that mean? And sorry, and just to be clear, does that make you Alex Ferguson? Are you the coach or are you the owner, like the Glazers kind of thing?
I'm probably more like the Glazers than I am Alex Ferguson because I'm like kind of running the whole business. But, you know, it's a very big comparison to make, so I'm not going to make that. But I'm going to say this, right? Ultimately, there's two major differences from us to like a Real Madrid or a Man United. And that's, firstly, we're in multiple games. So we're in anything that is an esports title. So, you know, whether that's League of Legends, Fortnite, FIFA, Call of Duty, we are in it, or if they're big enough, and we can go into it. So if any new game pops up in a new region or new market, which inherently is super exciting and is an advantage, because ultimately, you know, like Man United, they're kind of limited by, if they're doing badly, they're not actually able to like still buoy the brand with other areas. And the second major difference is that we also are managing effectively creators. So we have these creators who are at the pinnacle of their kind of gaming prowess, but they're making content on YouTube, they're making content on Twitch, and they basically represent our brand. So it's like a hybrid between, you know, a multi-sport sports team and a kind of basically talent management brand, a little bit like Nike manages talent or Gymshark has talent, etc. And so what that comes to be is that we are effectively an esports performance brand. So we don't actually consider ourselves as purely a team. We actually consider ourselves as representing the betterment of gaming, the pinnacle of gaming. And that means that now we're producing our own clothing, we're producing our own hardware, like keyboard, we produce headsets. And we're actually very unique in that, and that no other team does that.
Well, and you did a collaboration with Gucci.
Yes, we did it. I'm actually not wearing the watch right now. It's a pretty watch, everyone listening. But yeah, we did a collaboration with Gucci.
I mean, that is amazing. But I mean, in all seriousness, like take a moment, like, you know, anyone listening, like that is a great example, because Gucci is, you know, arguably at the moment the number one fashion brand in the whole entire world. And, you know, to be doing a partnership, you know, not something that they would take lightly. And, you know, if you could write a list of the people that you'd want to do a partnership with, Gucci would be number one on there. So that is it's just unbelievable.
Thank you. I mean, it was something that, you know, coming into 2020, if you'd asked me in 2019, like, could you imagine you would be here, you know, in 2004? And the answer would have been like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But then if you ask me, like, you know, 6 months later, if you imagine if I'd be where I was when we're announcing BMW and then Gucci, like, no, like, I think that's the truth of it. Like, I never would have imagined that we would have created a collaboration with one of the pinnacle fashion houses in the world. The last time they did a collaboration was with the Yankees in 2018. And it was something that the creative director of Gucci met with our pro team, the League of Legends guys, and personally designed the watch. It was just insane. And obviously, like, you know, it's something that hopefully we're going to do a lot more stuff in the future with these types of brands. But it is surreal in some ways that a kind of gaming team is able to do that.
Yeah, it's amazing. So now let's go back. You know, you've gone from Southampton, you've gone to this first first event, you've won, like you said, which is great. Your mum's obviously delighted because she's part shareholder with you. What happens next? So, like, take me through the next 2 or 3 years. And, you know, it's also worth saying that actually, you know, how we knew each other originally was actually you were running an agency on the side as well, Neverbland. And so, you know, is this part of that journey also because, you know, there wasn't a lot of money involved in esports at the time and you had to have another company going? Like, take us through some of the actual journey as an entrepreneur, like making money, supporting yourself, like all of these things, because it's been a long journey for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I started it when I was 19, you know, I basically grew it over the next 3 to 4 years. And the reality was that we were running, and I keep using this as a reference, basically like what an Ultimate Frisbee team is now was how big we were, right? It's kind of a very small, it was before Twitch had even existed. It was before, you know, live streaming had taken off. It was even before YouTube had taken off, really. It was like the beginning of YouTube. And so it was like really hard to get brands interested. It was really hard to get media rights. And the reality was like, I'm running a team at the time. And it's like, what is, as an entrepreneur, is super hard to get your head around is that like, you could do great things for the company, but you can't manage if your team wins or not, right? And that's kind of depressing at some point. So for me, I got to the point where I was like, I don't know when this is going to get there. It's going to take a while. And I'm like, you know, at the time I'm reading like TechCrunch every day. I'm like really thinking about building products and startups. And that's basically, you know, I'd noticed that like we'd created a website with profiles and we had like almost 100,000 people every week on our website just chatting to each other. And I was like, wait a minute, like, you know, Facebook is coming up, like gamers want to talk to each other. Doesn't it make sense to create a gaming social network? So I launched YouGame. We got our first bit of outside funding. We launched on TechCrunch. Like we had 2 articles on TechCrunch in the heyday of TechCrunch when it was like, there was no other tech press. It was like just TechCrunch and like some random other websites. It was 2007.
Mashable.
Yeah, Mashable. Yeah, it was probably before Mashable. Like it was super early in the tech scene. And I basically started running a tech product because I was like, I want to build a scalable company, which is kind of outside of, and we got to 300,000 users. You built a 10-person team. I moved to London. You know, I was like in the middle.
Where were you at the time?
Southampton. So I did it all out of university. Yeah, for like 5 years and then moved up to London. I was like, wow, big city, so much opportunity. And basically I started pitching VCs and we got like pretty far down the line with Intel Capital and I went to Silicon Valley and I was like talking to them. You know, in London, turns out that one of my best friends in the world, who wasn't my best friend at the time, was Kieran O'Neill. And he had started a gaming social network too, at Playfire. And we were actually, he had just raised from the London tech scene. And it was like, you can't really have space in the London tech scene, which is about 40 people at the time, to have 2 gaming social networks out of the one region. And then what happened was Lehman Brothers collapsed. And you know, all the VC money dried up. You know, our 300,000 users and a B2C advertising company where no advertising wasn't really kind of what people wanted to invest into. So I kind of slowly wound that up and I was like, well, I have 2 choices. I either go back to Fnatic and like know that I'm still kind of running an esports team and it's like going to take a long time and I don't know when it's going to be. It's an ecosystem thing rather than in my control to scale it, you know? And so instead, the second option was to take the development team that I'd created and start building, you know, I'd become entrenched in the London tech scene and start working on other, you know, people's startups and helping them build their products. And so that's basically what we did. I launched Neverbland. It became like a product incubator. I ran that and, you know, basically built up to a team of 40 designers, developers. We started building other people's products. Like we worked on some companies like Bulb. We did their early product and the design, especially Everpress, a number of London tech startups we worked with at early doors. But I kind of quickly got, it's working for others, man. It's not, I've never been able to do that. Even though it was my company, I just didn't really like, you know, I always wanted to run their companies basically. You know, so I ended up like basically bringing in a CEO and building my own startups off the profit of the agency. And I launched 3 startups inside of that agency. One of them was called Voted, one of them was called Conjure, and another one was called Slate. And Slate was like an agency pitching tool, which basically was the end of the Neverbland story because I sold it in 2015. And yeah, that kind of, I can finish it up, or I've been talking for ages, so I kind of like, yeah.
No. So just take us through that though. So when you say like Slay sort of ended the Neverbland story, do you mean as in you created the product there and as soon as you had the sort of finality of selling that product, you were like, I'm done, I want to go back to Fnatic? Or what do you mean?
So basically what happened is like I was like chaperoning Fnatic from the side as chairman, watching it grow, supporting it where I could. And, you know, in the meantime, I'd brought in a CEO who is now running the agency business whilst I was running the product business inside of Neverbland, the products we created. We'd gotten a product up to be in a pretty good place, Slate, where we had like maybe like it was a B2B SaaS product for agencies to pitch. And it's still going today, by the way. And so is Neverbland. Like they're all still going today. So,
and you're still a shareholder and et cetera, et cetera. Do you turn up for meetings or?
Well, I just sold actually. So I sold Slate in 2015 to a New York company called Extreme Reach. And that was when I was like, okay, well, unless I raise funds, and I was thinking about building like a BetaWorks style structure where I like building tons of internal startups and raise capital for that. Or I go back to Fnatic, and one of the hardest things about, you know, probably a lot of your audience is trying to get customers is probably the hardest problem for tech startups, right? Like a lot of tech startups are engineers. A lot of them are like marketing people. They're like great at building a product or, you know, product market fit. And then they're kind of like not great at marketing or getting customers or really scaling. And that doesn't come natural to them. Whereas Fnatic had the opposite problem, right? We'd have millions of followers across social media. We had tons of customers, but we didn't really have a product that was like generating us significant revenues. We were just relying on some sponsorship deals. And that's when I was like, okay, I've sold Slate. I can actually come back to Fnatic now and actually take my product knowledge and like basically start to create a vertical integration and start to have more value generated by doing our own products. And that's basically where I basically said, hey, you know, Scott, I'm going to go back to Fnatic. And that's the kind of whole transition from being, you know, what had been, I guess, the early dark ages of esports. And then, you know, while I was at Neverbland, it was like the middle ages of esports. And then kind of around 2016, when Twitch got bought for $1 billion by Amazon, it entered the kind of, I don't know, the modern era. And that's when I came back to basically raise our first outside capital, buy my mom out, buy a hardware company, and start running Fnatic, basically.
I want to tell you guys about the immense e-commerce marketing platform called Klaviyo. It's what I've been using at my own startup since we got going to get a full 360-degree view of my customer, and I've not looked back since. Plus the fact that 50,000 other growing e-commerce businesses use it to find out what their customers are doing so they can analyze and act on it to convert means they're the perfect solution. Whatever scale you're at, from your first million to your first billion, Klaviyo sets you up for success on that journey. Visit klaviyo.com today to find out more. During this time of you being at Neverbland and staying on the, you know, the side of the business that, you know, was essentially there was product market fit, people want tech products, you were building, you were designing, etc. Who was running Fnatic? What was your involvement there? Like, how did that work? And was it like a bit much at times? Did you feel like quite a lot of stress, like having these sort of two worlds, so to speak? Or did you try and separate yourself from Fnatic for the time being and go all in on Neverbland?
The reality is that like I had my mom and I had Patrick, and Patrick was our kind of like CGO who was used to be the Counter-Strike captain.
I'm assuming that's chief gaming officer for anyone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Bingo.
Which I created, by the way, as a title. And now there's like every team in the world has a CGO. It's kind of crazy. But there's loads of little things like that where you're just like, oh, it's cool. I created that like position in the world, you know, and now it's in the esport world, it's a common position. Anyway, basically I was like kind of chaperoning, trying to like stop my mom and Patrick fighting too much. And, you know, at the end of the day, like my mom was a very good doer, but she was also kind of like not a great leader. You know, she was very emotional. She was extremely like, you know, she was fair, but at the same time she and always like paid the bills and always like sorted out like the kind of finances and was, and it was very ruthless and probably what was needed in that time. But if we were to scale, we needed like a more risk-taking approach. And at the same time, my mom was kind of time that she had retired a little bit, you know. You know, it was tough. It was a tough challenge to like sometimes stop Patrick from quitting and like keep the team together, especially when I'm not focused on it. And, you know, sometimes there was some significant problems, and even thought about multiple times when I had offers to sell it, like maybe it's time to just like, you know, sell it and move on and I'll just become a full on tech startup guy. Honestly, like after being in the tech world from 2007 to 2015, like I got really tired of Me Too software companies, like cloning other software companies. It just get like, it's so much more exciting to work on like brand and hardware and consumers and like millions of people. It's like, it just, that's why I got really excited to come back to Fnatic really.
Was this like a difficult conversation to have with your mum?
Oh, 100%.
Can you take us through like what that conversation, what was that conversation like? Because we haven't had a situation of understanding this kind of relationship dynamic on the show before. I'd love you to just take us through it a bit. It's like truly fascinating.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always been a product person. I started a product agency. I didn't really know I was into product until I started like working in tech, and I was like, wow, I actually really love design. I love the details. I love the tiny. And so one of the things that I recognized is that Fnatic was making probably like 3 to 4 million in revenue back then, which was like four times how much money we were making back then for our hardware partner, because we had Fnatic branded products and they were selling it. It was a company called SteelSeries. And I quickly realized like, well, hold on a minute. Like A, their products aren't that great. B, why don't we just do this ourselves? And see, like, that's kind of what I want to do. So I started to look at the time for opportunities to basically buy a hardware company. And it came to a point where we found this hardware company and we went deep into this process. And then my mom kind of backed out at the last minute. And that's what it was like, the kind of like, you know, we put all this work into it. And then she just like refused to sign a document. And it was just like, all right, there's something has to shift because we can't be like equal partners in this thing. And if I'm going to come back full time on this, then we need to sort this out. And so I kind of got mediated with a couple of friends of my mom's. And we, you know, because my mom was being extremely emotional about it. And at the same time, I was like, mom, if we want this thing to thrive and I'm coming back to it, I can't have you full time in this business, you know? And so, you know, we basically just agreed an offer, which was like basically $1 million for almost like, I would say like 35% of the company. And with that 35%, I basically went out, acquired this hardware company. I then raised our first bit of capital, raised $2 million on a $17 million valuation. And basically began the kind of next phase of Fnatic, where now we're a product company. You know, now I'm back in the business, but not CEO yet. Ultimately, my mom recognizes it was the right thing to do, and that she was like, she's now enjoying retirement by constantly traveling and like always on the go and just having fun. So I think it's hard when like Neverbland had been my like all my learnings from reading the. Everything about starting a business, you know, how to build, how to hire, how, you know, reading books by Joel Spolsky and like, you know, get smart and get shit done, you know, doing all of that. And then coming back to Fnatic and like trying to like change this monolithic like tanker, which has been built from the complete opposite of what like the tech way of building things, you know, the startup way of like hiring and five people interviewing process. Anyway, it's been a crazy journey to get where I am today from that sense.
And how many people did your mom have at the time, and where were you based?
So we're based in London. We're based in Shoreditch. We'd set up an office actually. I mean, obviously because it was close by to where I was, it was in basically an apartment. We were about 15 people. We turned in living room into like an office, which probably is illegal, but you know, we're not in it anymore, so it's too late. But
and besides, I'd be coming for your mum, not you.
Yeah, exactly. Like back then, you know, like my mom had never like hired people. She'd hired physios. You vet them on physio. The reality is that we'd hired a bunch of people who were kind of like volunteers / like interns that then just kind of stumbled into like, you're now running all of our global sales, you know. Like it's definitely, if you had to start a company from scratch, in hindsight, it probably would have been better to just like kept the brand and then just rebuilt the entire team. But instead it was like attrition. You had to like one in, one out, like, oh, I don't want that function to drop off. But that took like 2.5-3 years, which is probably in hindsight, just pull the band-aid off, suffer for like 2 or 3 months as you're hiring the people, and then, but probably move much faster.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Was there a period of time where you and your mum had a strained relationship because of this? Or did you sort of, after the mediation, just agree, like, this is what's happened, this is the outcome, like, let's go back to essentially like a normal parent-child relationship rather than professional one? You know, like, how do you have that conversation?
That was the main point for me. It wasn't just the, like, I want to run the business. It was like, you're no longer my mom. Your, like, only thing is, like, constantly, like, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we doing this? And it's just like, mom, I just want you to, like, ask how my life is, and, like, us to just talk about, like, what the UK weather is like, you know, come on, let's talk about, like, you know, what we ate for breakfast. I know it sounds mundane, but, like, every time I'd have a conversation with her, because I was running another company, it would be like, I need to ask you about this in Fanatic. And it was just, that is, like, a real hard place to be. And you know, so actually afterwards, it was basically a rule that we just don't talk about Fanatic. I was like, it was more about changing her behavior of, like, stopping those frequent questions all of the time. And from my side, like, mom can, you know, I love you. Obviously, we're very similar as personalities. So, like, it's better if we just let me run it for a bit, you know, like, let me do this.
Okay, so moving forward, you said you raised a couple of $1 million. You did a $17 million valuation. You're not CEO yet, but you're back inside the company that you founded and you're kind of finding your feet. What's that experience like? And, you know, how did you make the transition back into CEO? Did you make that transparent inside the company that was your desire and what you'd be doing over a period of time? Or were you kind of enjoying being part of the company culture without having to take full responsibility?
The reality is that, like, I'd been CEO at Neverbland and I'd really gotten kind of scarred because I just wanted to work on product. I didn't want to work on customers. I just wanted to work on, like, in running an agency, it's like, there's not many levers you can pull. Whereas in a company like Fanatic, that it's a completely different structure. If you think about an agency, it's really just like 20 different companies in one, because you have every pod that's working on a different client. It's almost like a new company. And then there's like layers of management, but really it's, you're not really working together. You're working individually as creative pods. Whereas in a company like Fanatic, especially, is you've got every department, you know, from talent to marketing, to content creation, to back office, finance, legal, they all have to work in like harmony, which means that, like, there's kind of, it's more complex, but it's also in a way more rewarding because when they're working together, it's like moving fast. So basically, coming back to Fanatic, I was like, I don't want to be CEO. I want to just focus on the stuff I want to work on, which at the time, so I became like full-time executive chairman effectively. And, you know, at the time I'd hired a CEO into Fanatic called Wouter, who, you know, was probably like one of the first like real kind of operational businessmen type people that I'd met in the gaming world. He'd done a great job of like professionalizing what was effectively a family run business, right? So he'd started to like put in budgeting and like put in stuff like that, which made sense, you know, because coming back, I'd obviously built this team in Neverbland where every single person in the company was sick. They were like incredible designers, incredible developers. You know, now they're running like Facebook design, Google design, you know, all over the world. There's like ex Neverbland alumni doing cool shit in massive companies, you know, Google Labs, et cetera, et cetera. So it was like having that talent and then coming back to like this, oh my God, I don't even know where to start. You know, like I have to like rebuild an entire like speedboat from the inside of a tanker, you know, like that's kind of how it felt. And so I kind of worked in silo and then, you know, and did slowly but surely, I brought some Neverbland people in. I brought in some like new people. It wasn't until kind of like 2018 where I was like, this is not moving fast enough. This co kind of CEO relationship where I'm like chairman and basically running the company and you're also CEO is like conflicting. And so we basically had a mutual discussion that like it's time for him to kind of move on. It'd been like 4 years. He's now CEO of Excel, which is another London-based esports team. Yeah, I wanted to move faster. I wanted to make bigger changes. And that's basically why I took back the CEO position. And honestly, like, best decision I've made. Like, at some point, you've got to realize that, like, what maybe you weren't good at CEO in a previous position. Actually, when you look at what a CEO does, which is effectively judge and hire the talent, make sure you got great people, find the cash, aka sales, to run the business, build the vision and strategy so that everyone can get behind. With the three things that I'm like, and probably in a tech world, be really good at product. Like I really think a CEO should be great at product. And that's kind of basically what my skill sets were. And it took me to be like realizing that, I guess.
Of the six UK unicorns who have exited, can you guess what they all have in common? They've all been advised by our latest partner, Deloitte, and there's good reason for that. I know the joy and pain that comes with scaling a company fast. You need to focus on growth, your team, and customers, but often your attention is taken away by must-dos in areas like finance and compliance. I'm talking about headaches, like making sure you're charging VAT correctly on a new product, or your intellectual property is watertight, or having the right corporate structure for international expansion. These are complicated areas that you're really not trying to innovate in. So you need a partner like Deloitte who knows them inside out so you don't screw them up and you get more time and increase your chances of success. So whether you're an early stage startup or an international scale up, check out Deloitte's high growth team to help find the right answers faster. Search Deloitte Private to find out more. Fnatic has raised over £25 million in investment and has recently closed a round, including crowdfunding, at a £100 million valuation. Take us through your funding journey.
Raising our first bit of capital was obviously challenging, but at the same time, it became, now we've got to become a startup. And that means we've got to basically change almost every person in the company. And I don't mean that because they were the wrong people, but they were the wrong people for scale. Like, we needed heavy hitters that have done this before. And then in areas where you need that esports experience, you've kept it. So like Patrick is still here today. He's a co-owner of the company. He's a very pivotal part of our business. But the reality is that like we went through kind of this phase where we're like, we need to raise a big round. We wanted to raise around 15 million. And we brought in a company called GP Bullhound, which you may have heard of. And they kind of structured us, this very specific way where it's kind of like how a tech company would raise, right? So we went through the pitches, we spoke with them like and prepared for it. They then like lined up probably nearly 100 companies to go and meet with. And what ensued was, unfortunately, and this was not, their fault necessarily, was it was 2017. So there was like pretty much still an early adoption of esports in the VC world and the tech world. And really what ended up happening was I educated about 100 different tech companies on and VCs on what is the world of esports and where it's going. And, from that, there was only one investor that really came through. And that was like a really tiring process for me because I spent almost like a year kind of raising this capital, trying to get it together. The Americans had come off the back of that, they get sport, right? And they have a bunch of billionaire sports people, like hundreds probably of billionaire sports people. And so the American teams had just raised like 40 million, just like that, or 50 million. Whereas like you're based in London, you're like, we've got to compete with these guys. And we, not compete on spending, but just be able to like compete on buying players or getting players and being able to afford to operate. So we ended up pulling in what I think is a really great set of investors. So we have Barrangia, which is the only institutional we have based in London, but really it's mostly driven by family offices. So we've got an Indian family office in Unbound, or who are mostly known for telecoms in Africa and India. We've got the founder of VK.com, not the one that made Telegram, but the other one, which is Lev Leviev. And he's been really helpful and supportive of our business. And then we've got like a Hong Kong family office, as well as a number of angels and whatnot. And we managed to pull it together by hook or by crook to get a $19 million round done. That was the beginning of kind of now it's like I've got the remit to go and get all the people. That's when, I announced that in April of 2018 and basically became the CEO of the business again. And ultimately, ended up like hiring what I think now is such an incredible team. And I'm so excited to go to work every day to work with these people who are in pretty much every position, like better than me, and that's what's exciting when you've got an exec team and a leadership team where they've come from, like they've just sold their company for $300 million to a US company or, another one was, it's just an incredible experience to have such heavy hitters around you.
Now, you mentioned that you needed some of that money to buy players. How much does it cost to buy a player? Do you just get them for a year? How does that all work?
Yeah, so that was a slight misnomer. I would say that like the reality is that we were trying to do much more than most other teams with much less capital. So the reality is we're three things as a business, right? We're an esports operation where we're competing in the biggest titles and the biggest games, and we're getting money from media rights. We're getting money from the league sponsorship revenues. We're getting money from in-game item sales. Then we're brand partnerships team. So we work with some of the most forward-thinking brands in the world, you know, big brands like BMW, AMD, Monster Energy. And we work with them to basically appeal to youth culture, not just to have a logo on a shirt, but really to create content and be an agency for them in some ways for this world. And then finally, and this is very unique to us, is that we're a product company. So we have our own gear, we have our own clothing lines, and that's one of the fastest growing part of our business. In terms of like the money, so the money was being used, yes, for managing what is a very expensive esports operation. And of course, you know, some of the top players in our team are earning hundreds of thousands. You know, one of them is earning over 500,000. So a year, and this is just from salary. So this is the kind of level you're talking about where players are getting bought for millions of dollars now. A player from a competitor team was just bought for $5 million. You know, we've sold players for millions, but not really above a million as of yet. There hasn't been yet, but it could be soon. So we'll see. But it's like any other sport, right? There's a transfer window, there's scouting, there's academy programs, there's youth programs. And we're trying to be, you know, one of the best at developing talent because that's what we stand for. And that means that, you know, we always or generally have been net positive when it comes to transfers.
It's so inspiring to hear about all this success after 16 years of hard graft. But it's obviously not all been that easy. So how close do you reckon you came to quitting?
Once I came back, like never. Like that doesn't, I mean, for me, it's like the different periods were really necessary. I had to go and build Fnatic and realize that it's an esports team and it's not going to scale as fast as I'd like it to scale, right? And then had to create a tech startup and realize, wow, building a team, a tech team is hard. Getting product market fit and money is hard. And then, you know, I had to run an agency to realize that, damn, like working for others and building like services business is not for me. But through all those things, I learned everything about tech product building. I built an incredible network. You know, I pretty much know the bulk of the London tech scene's founders because of that period where we were all there grinding with like one to two people, etc. And then, you know, coming back to Fnatic, I had to have done that stint in tech to realize that like, you know, what I want to work on is something which is super hard, super complex, and super forward thinking and future. And I think now we're running a business which is part sports team, part hardware company, part software company, and part agency. And it's like, it is extremely complex, but at the same time, it is so damn exciting because every day I'm looking at like new funny video content we've created or another like cutting edge headset design or a Gucci collaboration or a BMW wrapped with a Fnatic logo. It's just like the most fun job in the world to have all of that stuff happening and then have like 4,000 people buy into your company who are just fans because they want to be along for the ride, you know? I definitely am not thought about giving in the towel. I think that's what most entrepreneurs are like, right? We're kind of like, there's obviously a time at which you break or you're getting to the end of your tether. And that's either going to be because you're working too hard and you need to take a break and it's okay to let the company to run on its own for a little bit. Or it's because, you know, you've actually reached the end of the possibilities of that business. I think the Fnatic possibility is still just beginning. I know it sounds crazy, but like, you know, we haven't even touched on the viewing experiences of AR or VR. The Ready Player One stuff is real. Like Roblox is real. Like this multiverse situation is going to mean that like, yeah, physicality will come to esports and it'll play a big part of making esports games. And suddenly, yeah, we will have competition for rugby and baseball and all of these sports with these super engaging, highly accessible titles and sports.
So final question, I'd love to hear about what you consider to be the hardest day of your business journey so far. What day was it and how did you deal with it?
The hardest day ever was basically around 2008, the end of 2008. And I kind of had Fnatic really struggling with cash and leadership. And at the same time, Ugame had just died basically because of not having, you know, money and funding. And it was just like, you know, I think we'd lost a sponsor or something. And it was just like, we weren't going to be able to pay anyone, we wouldn't pay the players. And it was that, like at that moment, you know, before I'd really had any success, that I was like, this is going, that I maybe I'm not good at this. Like, what made me think that I was an entrepreneur? Well, why did I think I would ever be good at this? And it was like failures of failures. And you start crying a little bit. And at that point I was like, you know, I fell asleep and I woke up and it was just like, you know, it's suddenly like the clouds parted, like, well, I'll do this, I'll do this, I'll do this. And suddenly it's like, you just find a way. And that's happened like never to that level of low, because, you know, once that was before you built up that inner confidence that like, yeah, I'm actually good at this. You know, I can get people to believe me. I can lead. I know I'm empathetic. You know, I'm a kind person. You know, these things, like once you have that belief, it doesn't faze you. At the end of the day, like everything could fall down and die tomorrow in what I do. And I'm confident that tomorrow I could build it again.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
The whole kind of culture behind the new hustle and working world and being seen to be working all the time and achieving all the time, and but also being told at the same time to sit down and put a face mask on and have a bath and never to tell people to work hard because they need to do self-care and all of that. I think as long as you're listening to all of these voices around you telling you to do 100 different things at once and sit down and stand up at the same time, then you're never going to be able to find that balance.
That was the social media sensation, mega influencer and young business empire builder Grace Beverly, with over 1 million followers on Instagram, three companies and a philosophy on clear boundaries and balance. She'll be joining us to chat about working hard and hardly working. Tune in or you'll miss out. If you'd like to hear more leadership stories, we now send a weekly email newsletter. It takes less than a minute to read and provides some enjoyable factoids about great leaders so you can impress people with your knowledge and maybe even become a better leader yourself. You can sign up at our website, secretleaders.com. This episode was brought to you by me, Dan Murray-Serta. I encourage you to follow me on social at Dan Murray-Serta for all sorts of stories on mental health and entrepreneurship. But we've also got our social channels at Secret Leaders back up and running now too, so go follow us there, particularly our brand new YouTube channel, where you'll be able to see interviews just like today's on video. If you enjoyed today's episode, screenshot and tag us to share the episode or tweet us. It means a lot. And if you really loved it, why not review us, please, too? It only takes a second. This episode was produced by Rich Martel, with editing done by Harry and Daniel at Lower Street Media, artwork by Charlie Stopford, and bringing it all together, our head of podcasts, Will Stollerman.